Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing. Welcome to the show today. I am very, very excited to have my guest join us today for a special Father's Day episode of the Organic Gardener Podcast. Coming to us from the Long Island Sound, close to where I grew up, is a special father whose daughter, Alethea, introduced us after she was on my show in episode 32 back on April 9th, 2015. Alethea told me the story of a man who was a natural educator who loved gardening and would take her around the neighborhood as a child, and they would plant gardens in friends and neighbors' gardens. And so today we're going to have someone who's going to share with us not just organic techniques, but how to help educate people and just share a love of gardening. So welcome to the show today, Peter. Oh, and his name is Peter Vasilis. So welcome to the show today, Peter.
Well, thanks for having me.
And go ahead and tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Well, I've been gardening since I was a kid, and it kind of developed in the last 15 years into a farm, a small farm, maybe 8 acres. It is 8 acres. And I ended up doing a market with a friend of mine who started an organic market for organic farming only. She had two farmers, and one wasn't responsible. Well, one was just starting out, and I hadn't even started out, but he ended up having a baby, and he was very discombobulated. So she said, "You got to help me out. I need two farmers, and the market will be a lot better." So I had stuff growing, and I started. It was early in May sometime in May, and I started growing a few more things. And it was just like a hobby, and before you know it, I actually had another farmer who was a conventional farmer wanted to grow things organically on my land, and that's what I wanted to see happen. Unfortunately, that didn't work out for the long term, but so I kind of took over because I had certified for him, with me, we were doing it together. He was my neighbor out where we are on Eastern Long Island. Unfortunately, we had 9/11. And he lost his truck at the World Trade Center, and then he kind of cooled off on organics because I think this someone was giving him he was doing markets also, and they weren't really into organics enough. He was too ingrained in his way as a conventional farmer. But anyway. So one thing led to another, and I ended up with one tractor, two tractors, three tractors, and all kinds of equipment, nothing fancy. So I've been increasing every year what I'm growing and the yield, and then of course it's certified organic by Melissa, New York. So basically, that was my second job. I was a contractor. I still do some contracting work, kitchens, bathrooms, stuff like that, but not as much. Farming just takes up too much of my time. Anyway, so that's kind of like a little background.
I like that. And so it seems like it must be very profitable then for you if you're able to not have to take as many contractor jobs and you're able to make a living off of farming. And also if you're buying tractors, it sounds like you're turning a fair profit.
Well, it's not earth-shaking, but it's not the whole year either.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
So, I do some more work in the winter when we close the fields and there's nothing to, actually there's stuff to sell if you store it. But usually after Christmas, there's some downtime until you have to start seeding for the next season. But I've also been buying some seedlings from places so I don't have to heat my greenhouse early in the season. Mm-hmm. It seems the cost-effective way to, you know, buy seedlings from a grower, a certified organic grower, of course. Anyway.
So, I think so. I was wondering, I went to the farmer's market down in Missoula here in Montana and this weekend, and they had some huge tomatoes. And this guy just happened to ask the girl while I was standing there that he was going to buy. He's like, how do you get ripe, giant tomatoes like this in June already here in Montana? And she was saying that they had somebody who started them in their greenhouse in December, and then they moved them to their hoop house in February. And they would heat their hoop house with a wood stove. And I thought, I was like, what are these $10 a pound tomatoes? How do you heat a hoop house with a wood stove? But she said, no, they were $4 a pound, which I still thought seemed, I don't know, for a tomato. But
that was expensive?
Well, you know, I don't know. I guess organic tomatoes, maybe it's not. And I don't usually buy tomatoes. Either we grow them or I don't eat them out of season very much.
Yeah, around here in New York, the average price on those, you know, like $3 a pound for organic tomatoes and $4 or $5 a pound for heirloom organic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's probably average, and I probably just don't know because I couldn't afford to buy an organic tomato anyway. So, yeah, so I can understand that buying seedlings from somebody who would be cost effective as compared to having to heat your own greenhouse.
Well, I do three sets of crops for tomatoes. Like I only buy the first crop.
Oh, okay, right. Now, where do you get them from? Like, is it some other place in New York, or are they bringing them up from like Florida or somewhere? Or?
Other farms, and they also have greenhouses, and they sell. You know, they sell retail and wholesale seedlings.
Okay.
There's several good sources.
But are they in New York too? Like actually on Long Island even, or are they coming from somewhere south or?
One's in New York, in Connecticut. One's in upstate New York, where I've been buying for like 15 years. McEnroe Organic Farm, and they produce some really beautiful plants, and they use their own compost. They have a composting facility. And they use their own compost to grow everything for sale, for seedlings. They have a large farm.
Nice.
My farm is more like, it's not really a true business. It is and it isn't. I mean, I probably could have grown it more. There's other farmers around here that have CSAs, if you know what that is.
Right, uh-huh.
And they seem to be more profitable. And they, you know, they have a more steady, secure form of income because they, you know, they'll sell 500 or 1,000 shares in their farm, and they get the money up front, so the risk is taken out of it, and they just have to provide people with organic vegetables for maybe 24 weeks out of the season, out of the year.
No, can I just?
So I could have made more money that way, but basically I'm a one-man operation with a helper, and then I hire other helpers when I need them, and you know it's a lot of work. You know, especially like some crops are very weed intensive, and the weeds like carrots and beets and onions need a lot of weeding. Otherwise, there's too much competition for them, and you don't get many.
Mm-hmm.
So once you get the weeding done, you know, it's a lot easier, but then you still have to pick it and sell it.
Hear you, Peter. I'm totally there. Like, to me, it just seems so overwhelming to do all that and then get it to market. And you'll see, we'll get down the line too. There's a question I always ask about how do you balance the, you know, like I'm always coming up with too much product all at once. But it's not enough to take to market for us, but just, it's a lot of work. Okay.
Well, that it is. It is a lot of work, and what happens is that you end up with stuff that when everyone else has it also. So you kind of have to have your source all lined up to sell to, or if you don't, you'll just end up with a lot of stuff in the compost pile. And which happens anyway. You always have to grow more than you need. It's just part of the way it is. Once you get past a certain point, there is going to be waste. But it's probably not waste if you compost it. And so, is there anything else about that? Or?
We'll come back to that. But I like that part. So let's go back to your very first gardening experience. Like, I always like to kind of start out the show there. You know, like, are you from Long Island originally, or where did you grow up?
I'm a native New Yorker, Long Island, New York City. Well, I was born in New York City, but I've always lived on Long Island. And basically, I like more open space and trees than I do. Well, New York has a lot of nice parks and stuff. But so I always tended to be out in the woods or the field somewhere for fishing or something like that.
And but, so then, so your very first gardening experience, like, were your parents? Were you a little kid? Were you an adult? Like, what'd you grow? How big was it? Who were you with?
The family always had like a small garden, and everyone pitched in, and I kind of took over. And one of my cousins helped, but then there came a point in time when, gee, we had a little, like, problem with something eating the tomatoes, or, so you read about it, and you want to see how you can make the stuff go away, and not eat your fruits and vegetables, so you'll have more to eat, and then, of course, most times, people would show you, like, all the chemicals. Mm-hmm. I remember my father saying distinctly, well, you can grow, none of it has something to do with food, but you can grow a lawn now, and you put a chemical down and only kill certain things and your lawn grows. And meanwhile, he was talking about 2,4-D, which is part of Agent Orange.
Mm-hmm.
And then others like that. And then I read about it, and he just really struck me as like, counterproductive to use all these poisons on what you're going to eat that might persist. So, we always had this garden, and then I didn't want anyone to use, I guess it was my idea not to use any chemicals right from the beginning. I didn't really know if it was organic or non-organic. I was just reading labels and then researching it, and gee, this doesn't really sound like such a really good idea. I mean, it's kind of like, putting your nose to spite your face almost.
Uh-huh, exactly, right?
First, we're going to put some poison on it. Organic, you have to be careful with that stuff, too. But the idea behind all the organic pesticides is that they won't persist in the environment. At all, and a lot of them now are biologicals, and some of them are even mechanical. Like, if you don't have that many potatoes, you can kill this Colorado potato beetle bite with your fingers, and just monitoring the field. I mean, I have about half an acre of potatoes, and we've been just mechanically beating the bugs off off the potato plants. But
what do you mean by mechanically? Like, actually, just by hand, you mean?
Yeah, hitting them.
Cool, okay. Yeah.
Having a bucket and then taking, like, a rolled up, like a newspaper or something, and making it stiff, and kind of just gently brushing the beetles into a bucket.
Mm-hmm.
So they just come right off. They fall right off into the bucket.
I was thinking, because the other day I was down in our garden watering, and we get, I don't know what it is, but it's like this kind of a white, it almost looks like a soapy thing, and there's these itty-bitty tiny black bugs inside of it. I mean, it must be like their larvae, but it just looks like soap. But if you wash it off, it makes them go away. It grows on my oregano and just tons of my things. But if you just rinse it with a hose, it will go, they go away. I mean, sometimes they come back the next day and you have to redo it again. But that's kind of how we get rid of some of our bugs, is just rinsing them with the hose. Just, I mean, you have to aim the hose exactly like right on the bug and kind of spray it for a while. But
yeah, well, you can do that with aphids too. You soap and there's actually this stuff called Entrust, and which is a spinosa bacteria, and that kills a lot of worms. And it kills the potato beetles in their larval stage. And actually, you can see conventional farmers use that too.
Oh, okay.
They use the same thing for potato beetles in a lot of cases. So there's a lot of overlap now. And that's what I'd like to see someday is actually, you might think it's a little like weird, but I'd like to see organic farming like disappear.
And just,
you know, what I'm trying to say is that it should all be organic farming, and we wouldn't have to make the distinction between organic and non-organic. And actually, I think organic farming is having some influence on conventional farming. There are a lot of things that organic farmers use that conventional farmers use. And I think there's enough product out there, and there's a lot more research going on that... eventually, we'll have organic farming kind of blend in and, you know, influence regular farming, conventional farming. So when I say I want it to disappear, I want it all to be organic. And I think that's what happens. The more and more information we have about a lot of these chemicals that are being used for weed killers and stuff or their true colors are starting to show out. Of course, you know that they use Agent Orange now. Oh, it's never stopped. Well, 50% of Agent Orange is always being, has been used. At, you know, 2,4-D made up 50% of the active ingredient in Agent Orange.
Hi, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and it's one of the biggest sellers in the U.S. today.
I knew that part. But I didn't realize that it's what's in the Agent Orange.
Well, it was two chemicals. One was banned, like I think in 1973, and the other one, this called 2,4-D, is prevalent. Every time someone goes out and buys, say, a formulation, like it says Scotts Weed and Feed, or Scotts Plus Two, or Weed and Feed, usually the Weed and Feed in the Northeast. Is this chemical 2,4-D. So it's basically using 50% of Agent Orange. And people are just buying it, and they don't really know what they're doing. So education is very important, but it's hard. And doing it on a one-to-one basis is almost impossible. People just don't even want to listen.
Well, hopefully they're listening to us today. And we're going to share with more people. And I think you're right. I mean, they say the people buying organic foods is going up and people. And I think you brought up a couple of good points. Like here, like when you talk about your dad saying, wow, look at this new thing. Like I hadn't really thought about that before, that some people probably looked at being able to spray chemicals on their lawn and getting rid of weeds as like some kind of almost, you know, technological, you know, revolution, like some great thing that's come along and they, you know, that to them. And sometimes I think my mom's kind of like that, because she's always like, oh, we don't need to buy organics. You know, we've eaten this food for years. And I keep trying to, you know, impress upon her the food that you grew up growing, you know, that they sold in the stores back years ago is not the same food that we're getting today. The produce is different. And
yeah. Well, I always hear this, they always say, I love your grandfather. He lived to be 96.
Right.
You can't have a one-person study. Like, you know, when one person gets sick, it's 100%. When they don't get sick, it's zero. One person studies that, you know, obviously it's a fallacy.
And that you brought it up that back in that it started in the 70s, and they're showing that there are, you know, direct correlations between the rise in when we started applying Roundup and the main chemical in that, which is glyphosate.
Glyphosate.
I can never say it. Okay, so
glyphosate.
that and the autism spectrum, that the charts are just parallel. And so to say that they say that the rise in kids getting autism, you know, parallels directly with the increase in Roundup in our produce, in our yards, in our, you know, lawns. And so
unfortunately, other things correlate with that too. Doesn't mean that it's not true, but it's hard to prove.
Right.
So you can't prove that autism is caused by Roundup.
No.
Sure, it looks like it might be.
But there's
also many other things that became on the market, which correlate the same way. I mean, I can't list them, but I'm just guessing that there are. That's not like it would be a valid conclusion. Not that it would be invalid, but it's not a proven thing.
Right.
But it sure looks like something could be correlated with, you know, like autism, Parkinson's, all these neurological diseases too.
Mm-hmm.
So let's
maybe get back to the question so we aren't talking for two more hours and I'm not taking up all your time today because I know it's your busy day. So just tell us a little, like, what does organic gardening or earth-friendly mean to you? Gardening, earth-friendly gardening.
Well, it means not using stuff that, you know, is going to end up in your bloodstream that could harm you, hopefully, you know. When my grandfather grew up, basically everything was organic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back in before 1950. They would probably use sulfur and probably some other pesticides. Other pesticides hadn't been developed yet, is what I'm trying to say.
Right, exactly.
You solve one problem and you grow more food, you make another problem. In other words, they could kill all the weeds, but that created another problem. Oh, yeah, the weed killer might be hurting our health, you know?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Solve one problem, make another one. It's almost like a scientific postulate, you know? It's like this. That's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Anything, you know, I solved that problem, but see, look what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's unfortunate that a lot of people don't want to admit it. But even big companies are researching other ways to do things.
I think so, too. I think they're starting to embrace, different options out there and using more organic techniques, like you said. And hopefully we'll kind of come up with a, maybe not necessarily a compromise, but something that helps everybody eat healthy and cares for our food and our land at the same time. So who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques, like just when you started taking over your farm and learning about it, researching it?
I kind of learned, on my own, just by asking questions, reading about it, seeing what other farmers were doing, and then when you want to certify, you found out that, there's a lot of other things I didn't know about that I shouldn't be doing. So, you just follow the rules and then read about things, and it's really not a hard decision. I mean, I don't know if we could feed the world organically, but I think you could eventually. Unfortunately, chemicals made the world more populated because at first chemicals really increased yield. But I think that's changed a little bit now. I don't think it is pronounced the difference between, a crop being saved by chemicals. And, so in other words, we have a lot of people that were fed by conventional farming.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I'm trying to say?
Sort of. So when they first started using the different pesticides and things, the farmers were able to grow more food and produce more food. So that was helping more people have access to vegetables in the markets and things, is what you're saying, right?
You got a lot of people, in other words, it seems to me like we fed a lot of people, and then all of a sudden there was a population explosion. so, you know, all over the world, where a few people were producing more enough food for a lot of people, and a lot of people, like little farms, disappeared, and you had just a few, you know, less farms producing more food, and but meanwhile the population went unchecked. In other words, I don't know, it's kind of a theory of mine, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
We have that with overpopulation, it became harder to feed so many people. So maybe that we should have been having less children worldwide and managing things a little better. Maybe that's kind of a little like a radical.
Well, certainly
theory,
our...
You
know,
reason.
Survival rates went up, you know, infant mortality, you know, especially in like the industrial, you know, more educated countries, you know, people aren't having like, you know, 5, 8, 10 children anymore to keep the line going. Whereas, you know, in more third world countries, people are still kind of following that. And population is definitely an issue that needs to be addressed on a global scale, I think.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a real problem. I mean, maybe it is now. I mean, I think the food supply is, like, very precarious.
Absolutely. And getting the food from, like, I think we're growing enough food and we have the ability to grow enough food to feed everybody, but it's a matter of, you know where the food's grown, transportation, availability, certainly weather. Is, you know, in climate and all those factors are, you know, mixed in. And that's where I think organic techniques, because I kind of really started this journey way back when I first started getting Organic Gardening Magazine from Rodale's, and I had read an article about their test plots that they have down in Pennsylvania. And they, in the 1940s, they started growing you know, vegetables the conventional way and then also the organic way. And they were talking, it talked about that under ideal conditions, the conventional way would produce more. But when you had like any kind of a drought or adverse conditions, you know, too much cold or not, or too much water, anything like that, that's when the organic techniques were outperforming. And so, but the whole point of the article was that we have the technology to feed the world now, and organics would definitely be the way to help produce more food in places that are struggling more, that have more droughts, or too much rain, you know, or, you know, big monsoons or different things. But, it's just, you know, having the will to go about doing it that way. Anyway, let's talk about something that grew well this year, or probably last season we're still talking about. I haven't even got to. It'll be like the fall, I think, before we really talk about this year. But how about last season? Like, what grew really well last year?
Onions were really good last year.
Onions, okay.
This year, they're not so good.
So what do you think was good last year?
Well, there's a root onion maggot. That affects onions, and last year just didn't seem to be around as much.
Okay.
This year, I don't know, we had a lot of cold weather at the beginning of the season when we planted them.
Oh.
And my seedlings didn't come in good shape, and so this year my onions are not as good. But, you know, every year is different. I mean, some crops are always good, like zucchini. You always seem to be good crop of zucchini, and the peas seem to be good, and the potatoes are usually good, and the winter squash were really good last year. You just have to learn, you know. If you don't, I direct seed mine with a little earthway seeder, and sometimes you get too many plants, and you have to thin them out. Same with beets and carrots. And if you don't thin them out, I mean, it's hard to sacrifice some of your plants, but you just have to pull them out.
Yep.
Otherwise, the other ones don't grow. So it's simple.
So even using a seeder, it still puts a lot of seeds in the ground. Like I was just the interview with me that's going to air today. I talk about that like when it's time to plant the carrots, I'm always like, let's go get the grandkids because their hands are tiny, and carrots are just to me the hardest thing to grow because those seeds are just minuscule, and spreading them out, no matter how hard I try, seems to. You still have tons of carrots.
You said turnips, right?
No, carrots. I said tons of carrots.
Carrots seem to be better really tight than beets. Beets, you got to thin them out. And if you don't thin them out, which I did one year, I did not thin them out, and I ended up not getting any beets.
Right.
I got a lot of leaf and not many beets.
Mm-hmm. Because they just grow too close together, and just it's hard to pull. Beets to me are easier to pull because I eat the beet greens. So that's like tender beet greens. I'll either put them in my salad or I even freeze them and use them kind of like frozen spinach in the winter. But carrots, you know, I don't know if you can eat the tops. I've never eaten the tops to carrots. So
yeah, you can. I hear they make a soup out of that.
Really? All right. I'm going to have to try that. But, you know, the one thing about carrots is baby carrots are kind of good. But it doesn't seem like you ever get baby carrots. Like if you just don't thin them and make sure your carrots are far enough apart, I just end up with just little puny, like, you know, like needles. I mean, they're just tiny and nothing grows. I think
you might be missing something in the soil.
Yeah. Well, they grow good. I mean, we certainly get tons of carrots. It's just if you don't thin them, they don't grow. I think they're too close together. How about something you're excited to try this year that you haven't tried before? Something new or anything different that you're going to do?
Well, yeah, I'm gonna put up a little hoop house and grow cucumbers in it because cucumbers are susceptible to mildew when the weather gets cooler.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if I put them in a little hoop house and close the doors and it stays a little warmer, you know, I'll be able to have cucumbers later on. I don't really spray them even for mildew. Other people cover them with a row cover.
Mm-hmm.
You know what that is, right?
Yep. I learned since I started my podcast.
Yeah. So, I mean, you always find different things. You know, that's one thing I'm going to do this year. And then I've been mulching my potatoes with straw. And that seems to keep the weeds down.
Mm-hmm.
And the last couple of years, that seems to be working well. You just have to make sure you put enough straw on so the sunlight doesn't hit. But once they turn green, you're not supposed to eat them. They have a little toxin that forms in the potato, apparently. But you don't eat green potatoes. Did you know that?
I'm trying to think of, like, where are you getting the green potato? Like, if you pick them too early?
Sunlight makes the potato create it. I forgot the name of the toxin, but you can look it up. Just look under poison potatoes or something.
Okay.
I wish I could remember the name.
That's okay.
It makes me one of those words I always forget.
Uh-huh.
What it is, but green potatoes, the sunlight creates it. Like, part of the potato will turn green.
Wow, I didn't know that. No, because I have seen some potato, you know, even potatoes you get from the grocery store, sometimes they kind of have that green tinge to them on the edge.
Yeah, there might be some varieties that have that, but basically that's why potatoes are buried, so the sunlight doesn't hit them.
And that's why people mound them and make those big hills around them?
Yeah, they want to keep them buried.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good to know. My husband just mulched our potatoes. He's got a lot of potatoes planted this year, and he just built the hills up and then mulched them with straw just the other day, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How about something that didn't work so well last season? Was there something that didn't go the way you wanted to? Well, I guess you said the onions.
This year, the onions.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of mortality in the crop. Basically, every year there's something that does a little better. Like last year, the basil didn't do so well. It got a mildew on it.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of seems to be everywhere. On basil, for some reason. This year, there is none so far.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah, I mean, every year it's like something a little different.
Mm-hmm.
The year 2 years ago, we had a problem with some Hawaiian webworm or something on the beets and the Swiss chard. And they just, all these little tiny moss and these little critters were everywhere, and they just, you know, actually we got beets, but the tops weren't good.
Oh.
So every year it's like a different, you know, sometimes the tomatoes are better. Like, I find when it's hotter, you get more bigger tomatoes.
Oh.
And in the beginning of the year, tomatoes, you have to have enough calcium so you don't get blossom end rot.
Oh, really? Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's so many things like you learn by, I got this problem. You look it up in the book. Or you ask somebody, hey, what's going on? So all the farmers, share information. Even, conventional farmers, most of them are good farmers, Just that they were brought up on chemicals, and it's hard to change. And that goes for anybody,
So what can you do to add calcium to your tomatoes so they don't get that blossom end rot? I had no idea that's what caused it. That's
lime.
Add lime?
It's calcium carbonate.
Okay.
So you check your pH. Usually if your pH is a little higher, you have enough calcium.
Okay.
So, and you can't check every spot you're going to put a potato in, a tomato. So you kind of have to make a judgment and do a whole row and see what happens. But you don't want to use too much of something because you could overdo it.
Mm-hmm.
And go the other way and you won't get, have another problem.
Mm-hmm.
So basically you have to just take, do soil samples and see how well you can get.
Now, do you find over the years things start to, you kind of get the hang of it and look and you're starting to recognize different things and say, oh, this is what's causing that and this is what I need to add to this soil? Or is it kind of...
Yeah, I added lime to the soil for several years in a row and then I found that my pH was more acceptable.
Oh, okay.
We had a low pH here. Maybe 5.2, 5.4. So now I have it up to 6.3, 6.4, which is more acceptable. But for potatoes, you don't put 5.2 is good for potatoes. It keeps them from getting, scab or something. And I know that you're better off just potatoes grow. That's why they grow well on Long Island, too, because the pH is slightly lower. Which is good for potatoes, but not good for tomatoes. So for one crop, you need something, and for the other crop, you don't.
So then do you rotate your crops? Do you have to think about that when you're rotating your crops? I grew potatoes here last year, so then...
Yeah, right, of course. And then you don't put them in the next year. You move them somewhere else.
Okay. How about something you find is easy to grow and generally successful every time?
Well... I mean, there's plenty of those. You always get plenty of stuff, right? But zucchinis really grow easily. And aside from cucumbers dying early, they really produce well until they get a mildew. And eggplants, one year they're better than the next year. Peppers seem to be good every year.
Oh, okay.
Except that. There's also viruses that affect them, so you have to look for resistant varieties. But that's, I guess everything,
that's another whole thing. GMOs is another thing that we have to watch out for. But, it's not proven that they're bad, GMOs.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also not proven that they're good. My theory is that you should use something just because you think it's going to be good, and if it's untested. So, they can make GMOs to autism 2 or something, but that wouldn't be valid. But on the other hand, we don't know that it doesn't cause something. So, can you follow what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, but I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure that the science isn't in on the GMOs.
Well, if it's not in, everyone's not admitting it.
Yeah.
But my point is that, I can't prove. So just say I can't prove that something's bad for you.
Right.
Okay? You can't prove that it's not. So you shouldn't use it until you have more proof that it's a little safer than... than you say it is. So in other words, why use it if you don't need it?
Exactly.
They need it, but it tends to end up using more pesticides because they want to make it resistant for weeds.
Mm-hmm.
But they end up using more weed killer because the weeds become resistant.
Exactly.
So it kind of doesn't work after a while.
Mm-hmm.
Now, actually, they switched from Roundup Ready to 2,4-D Ready.
Right.
So, which might even be worse.
Mm-hmm.
Or, well, you can't get worse than once it affects someone's health, it's not better or worse. It's just not good. I mean, you follow my whole point is that if it's not proven to be good, why bother using it until you have more proof? Because I'm trying to prove it's, I'm skeptical about something.
Mm-hmm.
But you're telling me that it's safe to use, but neither one of us has, like, definitive proof.
Mm-hmm.
So then we shouldn't be using it. In other words, companies are allowed to use these things, and we end up being the guinea pigs.
Exactly. And that was one of my guests who was a scientist from MIT talked about that Monsanto had been able to somehow get it so the studies were only like 4 months long or 3 months long or something. And then they started like the things in the rats that started to show was after the 3 months or something. Like they hadn't been tested long enough. That was her biggest thing, was that they weren't running the studies long enough to be able to prove it one way or the other for sure. And so she didn't like that she thought that they should be required to have their studies go longer. My interview with Peter Vasilis from Orient Organic Farms on Long Island, New York is continued in part 2. Hope you're enjoying this special bonus Father's Day episode of the Organic Gardener Podcast. Remember, you can visit our website at awesomemontana.com. That's AwesomeMontana, awesomemontana.com. And just click on the Organic Gardener Podcast, Mike's Green Garden, and you can see the show notes to everything we've talked about today. Thanks for listening.